I'm again delighted to welcome Agnes Nairn, who's again, she maybe have something to respond about. She divided her time between France, on your comment on the French, and Bath, and she's going to be giving us a very interesting presentation as well around children and consumerism. Thank you.
To concentrate on is looking at how the consumer culture impacts on children's relationships with their families and relationships with their friends. And I also want to look at how inequality, which Oliver's touched on, is a very poor bedfellow with consumer culture. So I've called the topic Arguments, Bullies and Feeling Poor. Now, as we're all consumer junkies, I expect uppermost in your mind at the moment is how many shopping days there are to Christmas. Anyone got that just kind of? 278. There are in fact 278 shopping days left until Christmas, but I can guarantee that at the moment there are toy marketers who are already trying to decide what are going to be the best-selling toys for 2012. Does anyone know what the best-selling toys for 2011 were? Nope, maybe we've got more people who haven't been shopping for 6 months. That's great. Kind of depends how much money you've got. If you've got about 20 quid to spare, the best selling toy was this thing called Doggy Do, where you feed your dog full of crap and then collect it out the other end. I think it's kind of symbolic of the generation that we live in. If you've got a little bit more money, if you've got about 40 quid, you can have an emotion pet. So you can have fake emotions. And if you tickle Milky the bunny's feet, apparently he makes bunny noises. I'm not kind of sure what bunny noises are. If you've got about 200 quid to spare, you can have one of these fantastic ride-on Daleks. Which look rather, I'm not sure if they kind of exterminate parents and teachers, but they look quite cool. And if you've got even more money, you can have one of these, which is a child-proof iPad. Perfect. Which one of these do you think are most desirable for primary school children? The iPad. All right, let's just do a little test here and just see how brand aware we all are in terms of the brands that teenagers in particularly want. So, whoops, that was. I'm going to give you. I'm going to time this. So, see if you can shout out the brand when you see it. BlackBerry. Okay, that wasn't bad. Well, that was good. Can't see it for the front. Oh, it could be Hollister. It's actually Jack Wills. iPhone, that was good. Oh, Abercrombie. Oh, that was a really fast Abercrombie one from over there. That was quite stunning. Teenage girls? Benefit, yeah. Thank you very much, the lady over there. Oh. That tells us something about the marketing of Uggs, doesn't it? That everyone in the room, like, nanosecond, Uggs, go for it. Interesting. These are all must-have brands for teenagers. What kind of brands do you think are not must-haves for teenagers at the moment? Marks and Spencers. Okay. All right. There's some interesting stuff. And the idea of what makes a brand really desirable and not really desirable is something that's fascinated me for a long time. And I've done a lot of work around, you know, what is it about brands that make them must-have or, you know, completely not cool? So I thought we'd just have a look at some of the things that young people themselves have been saying. Let's have a look at this. Statement by some 14-year-olds. If you've got a whole gang wearing Lacoste, then you don't want to rock up wearing Reebok. Okay? Absolutely definitive teenage statement. And what's going on here with the brand is it's not about the style of the shoe. It's not about the comfort of the shoe. It's a symbol. So a brand is a symbol. And the symbol here is simply I belong. If I've got the Lacoste, I belong. If I've got the Reebok, I'm a total social reject. Right? But it's symbolic. And of course, the need to belong is a very common, universal human need. We all need to belong. And teenagers more than anything else. If you're forging your identity, you need to feel that you belong. And brands fulfill that function. And they seem to fulfill it internationally. I've just finished some work for UNICEF UK, where we looked at materialism in Sweden and Spain and the UK. And we talked to some Swedish girls. And these Swedish girls were telling us about the Chloe gang. And I thought Chloe was some kind of uber cool Swedish girl who had everything. But of course, I was wrong. It was the brand Chloe. And this is what the Swedish girl said about the Chloe gang. This is someone who doesn't belong to the Chloe gang here. She says, the Chloe gang like expensive things. They think they're the best. They say, I'm the best. I'm better than you. I have expensive things. And interestingly, given that they are the Chloe gang, they have real Uggs. So the kind of the symbolism is going to another dimension here. And there's something slightly less pleasant. It's not just about I belong or I don't belong. It's about I'm better. I'm better than you. And that's when it starts to become about bullying rather than to be about simply maintaining your identity. And of course, it's not just clothes. I mean, here's a quote from some work that some teenagers did for the Children's Commissioner this year. And they said, I've seen kids getting bullied for having a brick for a mobile phone. I don't know, have any of you got bricks? Used to. Possibly you use your bricks with pride as a kind of subversive symbolism. But if you're a kid, having a big phone can be a really big issue. What is it about the brick that makes it so unacceptable? Sorry? It's old, yes. And because it's old, it's what else? It's cheap. It's about it being cheap. And there is another level to this brand symbolism that keeps coming up in research that's done with young people. So we go back to the discussion about the Reeboks and the Lacostes. We see this. And the same girl said this. Yeah, if you come in plain white trainers, you're more likely to get bullied because, like, they think you're poor. And the worst thing you can possibly be is to be poor. And that discourse of poverty underlines the brand discourse. And it's something that's become incredibly prevalent. I mean, there's another study. Again, this is the study done by young people on young people. Why are young people under pressure to buy expensive brands? Two things. One, everyone else seems to have them. And also, none of us want to look poor. Anything to prove that you've got money. Now, is this a young people's thing, do you think? Is it just young people that have got this obsession? Major shaking of heads. In the UK, absolutely not. There is substantial evidence that parents also feel this pressure to look not poor. If we take the Bailey Review that was conducted last year into the commercialization and sexualization of children, this is what one parent said, and it's very, very typical. My eldest school shoes and coat were bought out of us worrying that he might be bullied if it wasn't the right look. I've heard parents say, I bought him an iPod so he wouldn't get bullied. As if somehow it's a kind of, you know, a Star Wars shield that, you know, you buy them an iPod and that will somehow give them interior resilience to bullying. But it's incredibly prevalent. Now, if we look at other cultures, I mean, this study I did with UNICEF looked at Sweden and Spain. I expect Denmark would be very similar. Sweden doesn't have advertising to children. In 1990, they banned advertising to children. Doesn't mean children don't see any advertising, because you can beam a channel from Scotland and it reaches Sweden and it goes around the legislation. But there is significantly less advertising to children. If you take Spain, Spain has only had commercial television since 1989. So the parental generation in these countries has not been affected by commercialism to the same extent. I mean, I think what we're seeing now is a generation of parents who are also commercialized. And therefore, we have parents buying into this idea that if only they buy their kids the right stuff, somehow they're going to be safe and secure. And it happens even before kids get to school. This was a mother we talked to in Taunton who had really very, very little money. And she said she bought this because it looked expensive, not because it was warm, not because it was hard wearing, but because it looked expensive. And of course, it's not just products. I mean, if you take family entertainment, someone you know is dying to go. You know, a trip to Alton Towers or Euro Disney or Cabri, you know, you've spent several hundred quid, and that's before you've got to the gift shop. Which, you know, you're forced through and then you have to stop and buy stuff. I mean, our whole culture has really replaced, you know, the public good of play with the profit motive. And it makes it very hard if you can't afford it. If you look at toys, a third of all toys are licensed now. And the incremental cost you pay on a licensed toy is 57%. A licensed toy is 57% more expensive than a toy that is not licensed. And if you look at things like the Star Wars franchise, Star Wars makes about $500 million a year just from selling the franchise, the rights to the Star Wars name. Or if we take things like High School Musical. High School Musical was a really low-budget film. It cost them about Disney about $4.2 million to make. But they managed to make about $500 million just on merchandise. So that, you know, the returns are massive. In fact, in our book, we talk about an analyst who was encouraging his clients to buy Disney stock because he said, the great thing about High School Musical is you can monetize it over and over again. It's not about entertainment for children. It's about a monetizing prospect. And if you look at play, it's amazing how that has changed over a generation. Here's a survey that was done by Play Day. Look particularly at the responses in terms of where do you experience adventurous play, outdoor natural space, and theme parks. You'll see there that for parents, 70% of adventurous play was outside in outdoor natural space. For this generation, it's less than half. 29% of adventurous play happens outside. And instead, 44% of kids now say adventurous play happens in a commercialized, branded environment of a theme park. And of course, Oliver was talking about education. Education is all about competition, plays on parents' insecurities. And of course, if you've got the money, you'll try and buy your child an advantage by buying some of this nonsensical stuff. Baby Einstein or baby Mozart. And if you put your two-year-old in front of a baby Einstein CD, suddenly they will understand the theory of relativity. It's guaranteed. Put them in front of Mozart, they will drift to the piano and start playing sonatas enormously. It's kind of got ridiculous. And I think what we've got now is, in the words of another teenager, you know, what we own symbolizes our family income, and what everyone wants is to look rich, which we know is nonsense, really. I mean, the Beatles told us money can't buy us love, so it must be true. And if you look a little bit more recently than the Beatles, in our UNICEF survey, the very first question we asked to children in schools was, what makes a great day? And it was pretty much universal across all social classes, all countries. It's about family, it's about friends, and it's about having fun outside. That's actually what kids want. That's what makes them happy. So why, oh why, are we spending all this money on crap? That's something that Ed Mayo and I looked at in our book, Consumer Kids. And the first thing we tried to work out was, well, how big is the kids market? Has anyone got any guesses? Worldwide, what do we spend on kids?
900 billion.
900 billion? Zillion? I don't know how big a zillion is, mate. 1.88 trillion. To put that into context, it's about the size of the GDP of India. Okay, so it is a massive, massive market. And it's therefore not really surprising that marketers would like just a little tiny proportion of that 1.88 trillion. And in the UK, we do a pretty good job of spending loads of cash on our kids. How much do you think we spend in the UK on 5 to 16-year-olds? Any ideas? Apart from Jim, who's just taken down the average by spending nothing over the last 6 months. 110 billion. All right. Collectively, that's not each one of us, except perhaps in David Cameron's constituency. 110 billion we spend. Sorry? It does include education. Yeah. Yes, it does include. So it includes childcare costs. Yeah. But it's still quite a lot of money. So why are we driven to buy all this stuff when we know it doesn't make us happy? And when our kids are actually saying to us, you know, it's not what makes us happy. Well, part of it, of course, is the power of advertising, which we've talked a bit about already. Here's an interesting statistic. You've got Apple. And as we know, Apple don't actually know what to do with their money, do they? They've got all this money, and it's like, what should we do with it? We don't know. Could give them some suggestions. One thing they do is spend on advertising. In 2010, they spent $691 million just on advertising. Right, so that's not paying the staff, that's not developing, that's just on advertising. That's quite a lot of money. How long do you think it would take the average British family to earn what Apple spends just on advertising in just 1 year? Hazard a guess. Several thousand years. 23,827 years. And that just gives you an idea of the disparity between, you know, our wealth and the might and the wealth of corporations that are advertising to us to try and make us buy all this stuff. It's quite incredible. And what having that amount of money does is it creates a thing that's called false consensus. There's been some interesting studies done that show that if people see advertising all around the place, they grossly overestimate how important that brand is. And for children, the really important thing is, what happens is what that girl said a few slides ago. You think everyone else has got one. If you see it advertised, you think everyone else has got one. And, you know, so you get, well, I'm the only one in the class that hasn't got Uggs. And the reason kids think that is because they see it advertised, not because everyone else has got them, because everyone else is having exactly the same conversation in exactly the same houses at the same time. But it's this idea of false consensus. And that can be awful for kids. They have this, I've just discovered about FOMO. You know about FOMO? No, this is my 17-year-old who keeps me up to fear of missing out. So teenagers have created a phenomenon that they now label FOMO. And it's a very damaging thing if you're a teenager and you feel that you're missing out. You know, to create a phenomenon around this is extraordinary. So this idea of false consensus is incredibly powerful. And, of course, there are other techniques that work in different ways. If we take celebrity endorsement. Celebrity endorsement is now in a quarter of all advertising. At the last Super Bowl, which is where more money is spent on advertising than anywhere else in the States, celebrity endorsement was at an all-time high. You probably know that it's where David Beckham launched his new underpant range. You know, 3.2 million on 30 seconds of David in his boxers. Not sure I'd pay that much, but there we go. Celebrity endorsement is incredibly powerful, partly because it works implicitly and subconsciously. There's a celebrity that you already have associations with, presumably positive. If you then kind of rub them up and down against, I was going to say the underpants, but that's not good. If they're associated with a product, the good things you think about David Beckham, for example, suddenly become associated with his underpants. I think we should leave this image now. But it's a very powerful effect because you don't stop to think. It's a kind of an implicit processing. And things like celebrity endorsement work like that because they work kind of under the radar. Now, we know that if we buy a face cream that's been endorsed by Beyoncé, we're not going to turn into Beyoncé. We know that, and kids know that. But there was a very, very perceptive thing said by a 15-year-old during the Bailey Review. And she was talking about media literacy lessons. And she said, we have media literacy lessons, and I know a little bit about advertising and how it works. I said, but I also have biology lessons. And in my biology lessons, I learned that if I stand on a pin, there's a nerve that sends a signal up to my brain, and my brain registers, ow. Another signal goes back down to my foot, and I lift my foot. And I completely understand the mechanics of how that works. But she said, it doesn't stop it hurting. And she went on to say, it's a bit like that with advertising. I can know how it works as much as I want, but it doesn't stop it working. And that's why some of these techniques, like the implicit processing behind celebrity endorsement, are so incredibly powerful. And what makes it more powerful is the amount of time that our children now spend in front of commercialized screens. We did some research to look at how much time kids do spend and discovered they spend about twice as much time in front of a screen than they do in a classroom, and about 1.5 times as much time in front of a screen as they do with their parents. So it's not really surprising that children are so incredibly influenced by advertising. And what this also does, of course, is it creates family conflict. There's plenty of research done in Holland, in the States, and in the UK that shows that there's a strong correlation between the amount of time that kids spend in front of a screen and the amount of arguments they have with their parents. And another strong correlation between arguments with their parents and their mental health. So if you've got this culture where you're constantly being bombarded with wanting, the first impact that's going to have is on your family relationships. It's going to impact on the relationship you have with your parents, which is, you know, for children, one of the most sacred things that they can have. That, in turn, is what seems to cause a lot of the mental health problems. Now, if we go back to this idea of not wanting to look poor, the impact of advertising is clearly going to be much worse for those at the bottom of the pyramid. We talked a little bit about inequality. If you're at the bottom, if you're the person in the hole, but you know that in this country there are people who are on top of that enormous great big pile, it makes it incredibly pressurized to try and show that you look like the person at the top. I mean, it's something that Kate Wilkinson and Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson talk a lot about in the spirit level. You know, this kind of social comparison is incredibly, incredibly damaging. And the fact is that today we have a more unequal society than we've had since 1864. So the levels of inequality now are back at Dickensian levels. Of course, the level of absolute poverty isn't the same, but the inequality has just gone so far backwards, it's incredible. But, I mean, the raw figures of children living in poverty are shocking. And when I talk quite a lot in schools and I talk to affluent children. If you ask affluent children, how many children in Britain do you think live in poverty? They'll say, oh, maybe 3%. And I'm sure I don't need to tell the audience here that it's a hell of a lot more than 3%. It's almost a third of children are living in relative poverty. And the children that I've talked to who live in this kind of poverty, for them, having brands is incredibly important. And it's much more important than it is for the kids who can afford to say, I'm not going to buy an iPod, who can psychologically afford to say, I'm not going to buy an iPod. For these kids who feel disenfranchised, they're the ones that want it the most. Remember, there's a boy, Toby, said, he said, I've had all my confidence knocked out of me. He'd been abused as a child. His mother was a drug addict. He had a terrible life. He said, but I buy stuff for confidence. He said, if I've got the brands, that makes me feel good. And he said, the problem is that I have to keep buying it, because if you don't have the latest, you stop feeling good. So you've got this hideous cycle of those who don't have wanting more, but it just keeps on going round. And if we look at the statistics, I mean, inequality is getting worse. It's got worse over the last 10 years, quite a lot worse, where those at the bottom are doing really badly and those at the top are doing absolutely ridiculously well. And what seems to be happening with young people is they're using branded goods to paper up the cracks of their insecurity. And the marketers are very happy to feed that, because, of course, what they're feeding is insecurity. They're feeding, you know, social insecurities, and they're feeding physical insecurities. And I just wanted to finish off by giving you a quote from a 14-year-old who was one of our steering group members for the UNICEF work. And this was how he saw Britain. He said, you can live in a dustbin, but as long as you've got a BlackBerry or an iPod, you're accepted, which is quite shocking, really. So what do we do? Well, I think people working with young people need to get themselves up to speed in terms of what's happening. We need more training programs about how marketing works, where it works. And we need to then get together with young people to talk about it, because kids don't, you know, in PSHE lessons, don't tend to talk about, you know, what BlackBerry and iPod culture is actually doing to relationships. You know, if you stopped kids and said, would you bully someone because they hadn't got an iPod, they would hopefully say no, but people don't think about it. It's just part of our culture now. The other thing we need to do, of course, is to complain to companies. Now, after the Bailey Review, the regulators set up this thing called ParentPort. Probably none of you have come across it because it's not been advertised. There certainly hasn't been £691 million spent on advertising the fact that we can complain. But it is there, and we can complain. And if more of us did complain about advertising, perhaps it would start some of the revolution that Oliver's been talking about. The other thing, of course, that's hugely important is to make sure that public funding for play remains buoyant. I mean, boroughs in London who are talking about charging people to go into their playgrounds. I mean, you know, that's not quite Euro Disney, but you wonder if, you know, school playing fields will be sold off to Euro Disney in years to come. I mean, it just can't happen. You know, play can't be commercialised. It simply can't happen. And then, of course, I mean, underlying all of this is we need a more equal society. If we did have a more equal society, we wouldn't have quite as much pressure on those at the bottom of the heap to constantly buy in order to show that they are just as good as everybody else. So thank you very much.